From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I was elected by this people. I was elected one time. I was elected a second time. And now I've been elected a third time. The 13th of April for me was like a third election. The people brought me back again.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Today we'll look at the crisis in Brazil with, among others, Greg Palast.
President Chavez just returned from Brazil seeking help in breaking the strike of oil executives who hope to force his ouster from office.
But first, we go to the Iraqi-Turkish border with reporter Prothap Chatterjee and find out what Vice President Cheney's former company Halliburton is doing in this war on terror. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology said yesterday it's looking into accusations that its premier laboratory lied to cover up evidence of serious technological flaws with the Bush administration's $240 billion Star Wars program. Tenured MIT physicist Theodore Postol has demanded an inquiry for months, and the chair of MIT's Aeronautics and Astronautics Department, Ed Crawley, has finally reversed course and recommended an investigation. Postol says MIT is potentially sitting on the most serious fraud that we've seen at a great American university. Implicated in the accusations and the federally financed MIT Lincoln Laboratory and MIT's provost, president, and corporate chair. MIT officials strongly deny any wrongdoing. South Korea began an intensive diplomatic effort yesterday to try to avert a nuclear standoff between its neighbor, North Korea, and its closest ally, the United States. Seoul asked China and Russia to step in. Ministers said South Korea could not afford to sit back and set the U.S. to take the lead as it did in the 1994 crisis. Meanwhile, the London Guardian has gotten a hold of a confidential British report on U.S. treatment of prisoners in the Korean War that has been withheld from the public for 50 years. The report is by a British major who arrived to help U.S. soldiers guard prisoners at the Kojaedo prison camp. Major Bancroft wrote, U.S. troops guarding communist captives violated the Geneva Convention on treating prisoners of war and regarded them as, quote, Oriental cattle. They handled them extremely roughly, including people who'd been badly wounded. Asked about the Geneva Convention, U.S. troops said, well, these people are savages. He said all U.S. units were inclined to fire on prisoners at the slightest provocation. The U.S. has asked Israel to suspend sales of military equipment to China over concerns the technology could be used to threaten Taiwan. Israeli government officials complied with the request so as not to jeopardize Washington's massive military assistance program to Israel. The State Department only one day earlier accused Boeing and Hughes Electronics with illegally providing China with satellite and rocket data that could be used for intercontinental missiles. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission yesterday accused the Tulsa-based oil equipment manufacturer John Pickle Company of recruiting about 50 workers from India, then keeping them virtually imprisoned at the workplace after they arrived. The lawsuit alleges the welders, electricians, and engineers were forced to work long hours for little pay, compelled to sleep in a warehouse at the workplace, blocked from leaving the premises, and placed under armed guard to assure obedience. Workers who protested were threatened with deportation. The New York Times is reporting President Bush will propose sweeping long-term changes in Medicare later this month. Administration officials say Bush's plan for Medicare closely resembles proposals advanced in the last 3 years by Senator Bill Frist, the Tennessee Republican who's become majority leader when Congress convenes next week. Like Frist, Bush says he wants to foster competition between the Medicare program and private health plans. North Carolina Democratic Senator John Edwards announced his intention to seek the presidency in 2004. The multimillionaire former lawyer declared himself a candidate, quote, for regular folks. Edwards criticized the Bush administration's tight relationship with corporations, lobby groups, and wealthy supporters. But he made no direct criticism of the Bush administration's so-called war on terror, other than to say he would seek to involve ordinary people more in local counterterrorism measures. Thousands marched through cities across Pakistan today to protest a potential U.S.-led war against Iraq. In Islamabad, some carrying banners reading, "American terrorism, Yankees don't spread hatred in the Muslim world." Meanwhile, the U.S. military said today it has the right to cross from Afghanistan into neighboring Pakistan in pursuit of suspected Taliban or Al-Qaeda militants. This comes after a gun battle earlier this week between U.S. forces and a Pakistani border guard. The U.S. military dropped a 500-pound bomb on an abandoned religious school in the border area to end the skirmish. 6 days after a cyclone battered several remote South Pacific islands, it remains unknown how many people are dead or alive, while the first relief supplies will not arrive from Australia until Sunday at the earliest. The London Independent reports the situation seems scarcely credible in an age of sophisticated communications and in a region dominated by Australia, a wealthy nation. The Solomon Islands are home to nearly 4,000 people, yet the first plane to fly over the area in an attempt to discover the islanders' fate was chartered by a freelance New Zealand cameraman. It was not until Wednesday that an Australian Air Force plane made a reconnaissance flight at the request of the Solomon Islands government. No food, water, or medicines were dropped. France is sending its foreign minister today to Ivory Coast, its former West African colony, as the four-month-old insurgency intensifies. Refugees fleeing the village of Nakas say people were butchered earlier this week by rebels sweeping southwest in a new offensive which threatens San Pedro, the port through which a fifth of the world's cocoa beans are exported. France condemned an attack by government helicopter gunships which crossed a ceasefire line in the north, killing 11 civilians, wounded many others. Hundreds have died and thousands have fled their homes since the failed coup in September opened ethnic divisions, what was once the most stable and prosperous country in West Africa. And the Office of Homeland Security lost the first round in a legal fight to keep its activities secret. The Washington-based Electronic Privacy Information Center is suing the office to release records on proposals for a national driver's license and for a so-called trusted flyer program that relies on biometric information to identify airline passengers. Homeland Security contends it doesn't have to release records because it is not an agency. But the U.S. District Judge Colleen Kohler-Cotley ruled the office must prove it has no authority other than helping and advising President Bush in order to have the lawsuit dismissed. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Bush-Cheney White House prepares for war with Iraq, few companies are set to benefit as much as Halliburton. Yes, that's the same Halliburton that Dick Cheney headed up until the controversial presidential election of 2000. The same Halliburton where Cheney made over $20 million. The same Halliburton that got embroiled in an Enron-like scandal due to questionable accounting practices under Dick Cheney's helm. And the same Halliburton that continued to quietly trade with Iraq long after the Gulf War ended. During the 1990s, Halliburton Corporation had contracts worth over $70 million with Iraq. Today, it is set to profit from a war against Iraq, as Halliburton has with the so-called War on Terror. Since September 11th, the Pentagon is increasingly relying on a unit of Halliburton called KBR, sometimes referred to as Kellogg Brown and Root. It has done work from building cells for detainees at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. It feeds American troops in Uzbekistan. And near the Turkish-Iraqi border, Halliburton helps run three U.S. military bases. In July, the New York Times reported, quote, "The attacks of September 11th have led to significant additional business. KBR is the exclusive logistics supplier for both the Navy and the Army, providing services like cooking, construction, power generation, and fuel transportation. The contract recently won from the Army is for 10 years and has no lid on costs." The New York Times went on to report that Halliburton is the only company that has a contract with the Army that has an unlimited budget. This comes despite Halliburton's questionable past performance on government contracts. Halliburton recently paid the government $2 million out of court after the Pentagon accused the company's employees of lying and overcharging the government. We go now to the Turkish-Iraqi border to speak with Democracy Now! Correspondent Prothap Chatterjee, who's been closely tracking Halliburton, recently visited the Halliburton-run base there. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Prothap.
Thank you, Amy. I hope you can hear me. This isn't a very good connection.
Yes, we hear you fine. Can you talk about the base that you visited that is run by Halliburton?
Okay, the base is just called Aden, which is on the Mediterranean coast of Turkey. It's the end of the pipeline for oil from Iraq, from the Mosul and the Kirkuk. Oil fields in northern Iraq, in Kurdish Iraq, in fact. And right around this base, about right around the pipeline, about 10 miles from there, is a little place called Incirlik. And about 50 years ago, the U.S. built a new air base, which has been run by Vinod Brown and Root, as you mentioned, for the last 12 years. They got a contract in 1987. They started work in 1988. And basically, they run everything on that base, from, you know, the washing of clothes to the maintenance of the vehicles. And they had something like 1,400 employees. I apologize. I think you can hear the call to prayer in the background.
You don't have to apologize. Maybe as you're talking, you can describe where you are, Prothap.
I'm sorry, Amy, you're breaking up. Can you tell me again?
Well, just as you're talking, if you can describe where you are as we listen to the call to prayer.
I'm actually in Habur, which is on the border of Iraq, the Turkish-Iraqi border. It's the northern border to Iraq, and it's a very interesting town in the sense that this is the main point from which people travel from Turkey to Iraq and from Iraq to Turkey. It's the gateway to the Kurdish part of Iraq, which is protected by U.S. and British airplanes. And it's also the point from which illegal oil, which is not permitted by the U.N. Sanctions, can travel into Turkey and be sold for cash or in exchange for goods. And so the Kurdish people get a lot of their revenue, the Kurdish people in northern Iraq, as well as Saddam Hussein's government, traffic all across this border crossing. And sometimes during the day, there are lots of trucks that are as long as 25 miles long waiting to cross into Iraq to get diesel and bring it back for sale. This is where I am right now, and that's where you hear the call to prayer, the evening call to prayer. This is actually Erbakan, which is the center of Kurdistan in Turkey, which is where the U.S. would like to set up bases in the event of a war. And in fact, they're looking at four bases in the Kurdish part of Turkey, in Diyarbakir, which means land called Batman, in a town called Malatya, and a town called Mus. I'm not sure yet if Halliburton will run those bases, but it's very possible, because Diyarbakir was previously run by Vinod Brown and Root about 5 years ago. The U.S. has withdrawn from here, except maybe 50 soldiers who have considered a low-profile presence. The rumors are they're about to come back, and it's very likely that Halliburton will be the company that will help them set up base, just as they did in Uzbekistan for the war in Afghanistan.
Can you talk more about Halliburton and the company base that you visited in the Northern Command, what they're doing there?
Yes, Amy, you'll have to ask me that question again. It's really hard to hear you.
Can you talk more about Halliburton?
Halliburton itself, as most of your listeners know, and you mentioned in your introduction, is a pretty old engineering company, brought to Brown & Root several years ago. Brown & Root being a company that does construction. Their roots in construction and working for the military go back to the Vietnam War. Halliburton itself is actually an oil construction company, and they're the biggest oil field services company in the world. So let's suppose Exxon or Mobil or Shell wanted to build a pipeline. They would probably hire Halliburton to build that pipeline. Halliburton, Bechtel, two of the biggest oil construction companies in the world. They bought, which is a construction company, although it's one of its specializations are in doing support work for the military. And Dick Cheney, who was Secretary of Defense under the pre-Bush administration, when he was asked to downsize the military, actually asked Brown & Root to look into the possibility of studying the possibility of the privatization of certain military functions, what I like to call the MASH functions, the washing of clothes and the maintenance and running of hospitals and that kind of thing. And Brown & Root produced a study saying they would be economical, and then as soon as they did that, they got the contract to run these very businesses. And since after Dick Cheney left the previous Bush administration, he became the chief executive of Halliburton and made a lot of money in the process. His departure package was probably worth in excess of $30 million in terms of shares that he had to sell in order to become vice president of the United States. And right after September 11th, they've been getting a number of contracts. They're looking at a new contract right now. It's currently being negotiated. Another three-year contract, the bases here in Turkey, in Ankara, Izmir, and in Incirlik / Adana on the Mediterranean coast, right by the Iraqi oil pipeline.
Well, Prothap, we want to thank you very much for joining us. We have a little trouble hearing you, but final comments before your next report.
Okay, well, thank you for having me, Amy, and hopefully next time we'll have a good connection.
Good. Prothap Chatterjee speaking to us from the Turkish-Iraqi border. And you are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about what's happening in Venezuela right now and also about Chavez's trip to Brazil for the inauguration of Lula as the new president of Brazil. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said yesterday he favors the creation of a group of Friends of Venezuela to lead an international diplomatic effort to end the month-long general strike. The Venezuelan leader made the announcement in Brazil, where he attended the inauguration of Brazil's new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Chavez said that he expected countries from Latin America, Europe, and OPEC, which Venezuela helped found more than 40 years ago, would help his country end the strike. Chavez also proposed forming a Latin American OPEC between Venezuela and Brazil. Chavez said Lula expressed his total support and predicted that Brazil and Venezuela will make great advances together in the coming years because of the similar views. To relieve economic pressure, Brazil last week sent an oil tanker with 520,000 barrels of gasoline to Venezuela. As for the ongoing strike, Chavez said yesterday, quote, "What's going on in my country is not a strike. It's a coup attempt disguised as a strike, organized by, quote, terrorists who are blocking oil and food distribution and sabotaging refineries." Meanwhile, the leaders of the strike called today on the military to join their cause. So far, the military has backed Chavez during this past month. We're joined right now by Greg Palast, who has reported on Venezuela extensively, an investigative reporter with BBC TV's Newsnight, the author of many books, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. He also contributes regularly to The Guardian and The Observer in Britain. Welcome.
Hi, Amy. Good morning. I bet that that George Bush and Dick Cheney were yesterday spraying their coffee across the wall when they heard Chavez's statement with Lula. Because what you have to understand is what Chavez is doing. Right now, they're the opposition to Chavez, which is the kind of white elite minority of Venezuela, is trying to bring his government to its knees. It's an elected government. They're trying to overthrow him by choking off the major industry of Venezuela, oil. And the U.S., of course, has openly backed the opposition to Chavez, and they thought that they got him this time because they'd bring the country to its knees economically. Instead, the guy shows up, Chavez shows up in Venezuela with the new president and announces that he wants to create LOPEC.
In Brazil?
Yeah, in Brazil, and he wants to create LOPEC, Latin American OPEC. And understand that there are four giant exporting petroleum-exporting countries in Latin America, which are, except for Venezuela, outside of OPEC. Ecuador was forced out of OPEC by the World Bank 20 years ago. Brazil is an oil-exporting country. And then there's Trinidad and Tobago, which where I was just there 2 days ago, which jointly produces oil with Venezuela on their common coastline. And what Chavez is proposing is that these four countries, which now, just from the last few months, now have four leftist presidents, elected presidents, saying, okay, well, if they're squeezing all four of our nations, why don't we just get together and say, hey, we've got the oil. So you can imagine Cheney and Bush, who are oil men, thought that they got this guy by going after the oil industry, and Chavez turns around and says, well, guess what? We've got the oil. We'll work together. Now it's our move. He's a very good, as Chavez told me in April when I spoke to him, he says it's a chess game, and this guy's a very good chess player.
Actually, let's go to the interview that you did with Hugo Chavez last year. Maybe you can set it up for us. We're just playing a small excerpt of it where you asked about whether he is a dictator. Where were you?
Well, actually, I was in the presidential palace with Chavez. We spent several hours together, and this was just after the attempted coup. The guy was kidnapped and taken off in a helicopter and had just returned. So I was trying to find out what it was like to be assuming that you're about to be thrown out of a helicopter. And I wanted to ask him to answer some of the charges that you see in our papers of record, like the New York Times. Are you a dictator? Well, tell us about yourselves.
Let's take a listen. This is Greg Palast's interview with Venezuelan President
Dictador
Hugo Chavez.
Dictador fue el que se instaló aquí.
A dictator was what was installed here in the presidential palace in an illegitimate way for a day and a half.
Dictadura fue la que se instaló aquí después del golpe.
That was a dictatorship, what happened after the coup.
Un supuesto presidente que se juramentó él mismo.
A supposed president who swore himself in.
Ese sí es un dictador.
That, yes, is a dictator.
Yo fui elegido por este pueblo.
I was elected by this people.
Fui elegido una vez.
I was elected one time.
Fui elegido la segunda vez.
I was elected a second time.
Y ahora la tercera vez.
And now I've been elected a third time.
El 13 de abril, para mí,
the 13th of April for me was like a third election. The people brought me back again.
Dictador, yo.
Am I a dictator?
Que además de ganar las elecciones,
in addition to winning the elections,
el 6 de diciembre del 98,
on the 6th of December of 1998,
lo primero que hice al llegar
the
a
first
este
thing
palacio,
I did when I got to the presidential palace
decreto,
was to sign a decree,
no de dictadura,
not of dictatorship. It wasn't a dictatorship. It wasn't a decree to eliminate the National Assembly, like what was assigned here during the coup, which was a dark day for Venezuelan history. I, on the first day of my presidency, and on the 2nd of February 1999, I didn't try to eliminate all judicial power and concentrate it in myself to try to ruin the Constitution, to trip up the people. Mine was a decree, and it was the first time in 200 years of Venezuelan history to start a referendum and ask the Venezuelan people what they wanted, what kind of constitution they wanted. What dictatorship? I've governed 3 years, and there hasn't been one single political prisoner, one person persecuted for their political beliefs. No reporter can say that I have persecuted him. The media has not been censored. All the government has been elected here. All the governors have been elected. All the mayors have been elected. All the representatives to the National Assembly were elected. All the Supreme Court justices were elected. All the provincial governments officials were elected. Even the chiefs of the trade unions were elected by the rank and file, which is the first time this has happened in Venezuelan history. Am I a dictator? Whoever says that, they must be either crazy or ignorant, or there's some kind of bad intention. They're trying to fool somebody.
That was Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, interviewed by Greg Palast in the palace in Caracas last April. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and we're in the studio with investigative reporter Greg Palast, and also joining us from Caracas is Samuel Moncada, historian and director of the School of History at the Central University of Venezuela in Caracas. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Moncada. Can you talk about what's happening on the ground in Venezuela right now?
Well, right now we're having a coup d'etat, an economic coup d'etat by installments. I mean, chapter by chapter, the economic elite of Venezuela is trying to topple the government by strangling the economic basics of our country. The last thing they have proposed is a tax revolt against the government. They are asking big businesses not to pay taxes, which in fact is a nice deal for them, because what they are trying to do is to recover from the losses over Christmas because of the lockout they already have hit Venezuela with, and they are trying now to keep the money from the consumers and keep the money from the tax, and they are disguising that action as civil disobedience, but in fact what they are trying is to protect their interest. It's a corporate interest coup, which is asking openly on the private media, the top brass of the army, to rebel against the constitution. They are trying to buy top brass officers with massive amounts of money in order to rebel against the constitution. It's important to say that these people are not just trying to topple Chavez, they are trying to topple the whole constitution. I mean, they are in rebellion against the Supreme Court, for example, against the laws, against the Attorney General, against the whole rule of law. And the important thing is that they are strangling the poor. This is a lockout against the Venezuelan poor, which are the ones who are suffering right now. They are threatening with violence as well. I mean, it's important to see and to think that the five private channels, TV channels, are running around the clock, not commercial advertising, but political propaganda full of racist remarks, calling Chavez monkey, calling the minister, black minister, gorillas, and they are thinking that the media class, the middle class in Venezuela, are going to support them, and there are people like Gustavo Cisneros, who is a very good friend of Mr. Bush, president, and he's trying to buy himself a government right now. And the paradox of the whole situation is that Mr. Chavez is trying to sell oil to the U.S. and decide who is locking the industry and shutting the exports to the U.S. are Mr. Bush's friends in Venezuela, like Mr. Gustavo Cisneros or Mr. Isaac Perez Recao, who was the brain of the last April coup and is living in Miami right now, surrounded by a private army of bodyguards paid by the money he made out of armed deals in Venezuela, and is being protected by the Bush administration. I mean, it's important to know that the defense of democracy now, which Latin American countries are realizing and are starting to support Chavez, we have not the same signals from the U.S. and Mr. Bush administration.
We're speaking to Professor Moncada in Caracas. Would you like to add to that, Greg Pallast?
Well, I just want to give you a little bit of what's at stake here. The best way to think of Hugo Chavez is as the Mandela of Venezuela. You have, just like South Africa, you have an 80-20 split between a white, rich elite and a brown, deeply impoverished majority. And the 80% of the dark majority have been locked out of all the economic gains of Venezuela's extraordinary oil and agricultural wealth. And all Chavez has done is pass two laws, one to raise royalties on oil companies, mostly ExxonMobil. The other was to redistribute to the landless unused land. I mean, these are simple reform moves, and that's got him labeled as an autocrat and a dictator by the New York Times. But we should note that what's behind this is this racial economic divide within Venezuela, which Chavez is facing. That's why the professor was speaking about Chavez being called a monkey and basically all these racist remarks, because the idea is to enforce these racist stereotypes within Venezuela that brown people like Chavez, very unusual, the first brown president of Venezuela, the Indian-born working-class kid who's president. This has just never happened in Venezuela. So what they're trying to do is return Venezuela to a type of economic apartheid.
I wanted to ask you, Professor Moncada, about Hugo Chavez's comments in Brazil that this is not a strike, this is a coup. Even in the New York Times, there was a piece about how the oil workers had returned, although management was striking, and so they were taking over all of their activities. There's a very interesting piece that was on ZNet by a man named Hector Mondragon, and he is talking about the control of oil. He says the real strength of the strike in Venezuela has been in the computers that control the giant and highly automated petroleum industry. And he says, although the industry is nominally state-owned and run, the computer system is in the hands of the mixed public-private enterprise Intesa. The party with the technical skill in the partnership is the Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, a transnational computing company. Among its directors, ex-U.S. Secretaries of Defense William Perry and Melvin Laird, ex-directors of the CIA John Deutsch, Robert Gates, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, ex-director of the National Security Agency, other retired military staff including Wayne Downing, former Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Special Forces, and Jasper Welch, ex-coordinator of the National Security Council. That's quite a directorship there. Professor Moncada, can you talk about this?
Oh, yes. It's very important to know that it's not just the worker hands, the one who moved the industry and the company in Venezuela. As you said, this company is highly automated. And basically, what the top management has done in Venezuela is destroying the software of the company. The accounting system, for example, is totally destroyed. The computer system which controls the refineries and the pipe and gas lines are destroyed. They have kidnapped oil tankers, which are automatized as well, controlled by computers. But the important thing is that this Intesa company, which you just mentioned, controlled by this SAIC company, controlled by the top retired American military, the person who sold that contract to Intesa and to this American company is the former chairman of PDVSA, Mr. Luis Justi, who right now is an economic oil advisor to Bush's administration, to President Bush. and is a director of Shell. I mean, another big, massive oil company.
A director of Shell?
This very same person was the one who made that contract with Intesa. And Intesa is locking out again the computing system of PDVSA. And that's why it's so difficult to recover. It's not a matter of the number of people. It's a problem of software there.
Well, let me just clarify for the listeners. PDVSA is the state oil company. And of course, that's a real plum that the foreign oil companies would like to grab a hold of. But they actually work in coordination with ExxonMobil and British Petroleum mainly, and then Shell as well, but mainly ExxonMobil, in a combine called Intesa. So PDVSA can draw up all the oil out of the ground and out of the offshore drilling off of Trinidad, but they can't send it out unless they can get it through the pipeline, which requires the cooperation of their partners in ExxonMobil through this organization called Intesa. So I'm just trying to straighten out all these acronyms that are flying about. But so, in other words, Venezuela can be effectively choked off. All you need is a few sophisticated saboteurs, in effect, people who just shut down computers, and you've got a real mess when you're dealing with a highly automated system. So it's one of the rare industries in which you can basically have a kind of executive elite strike and bring down the company. Now, it has been effective. They've knocked out 90% of the oil, of the ability to move oil products and refined products, which is devastating to Venezuela's economy. However, if Chavez succeeds with the creation of a LOPEC, he can just be trading products with the other countries.
Now, he made that statement, forming a Latin American OPEC, when he was in Brazil this week for a historic event, which is the inauguration in Brazil of the new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. We're joined on the line right now by Maria Luisa Mendonça, who is in Brazil. Can you talk about this week's events and the inauguration of Lula? Welcome, Maria.
Thanks, Amy.
Can you talk about this week's inauguration of Lula, of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva?
Well, we have never seen anything like this in Brazilian history. People taking to the streets to see the new president, to celebrate this victory, because I think one important thing to remember is that this was a whole process of over 20 years of struggle. So people who were on the streets were so moved by this. People were crying, not only because Lula was elected, because most people felt that this is something that they participated in since the transition from the dictatorship to democracy in Brazil, the creation of the Workers' Party, the creation of an independent union federation, the coups, the creation of strong popular movements such as the landless workers movement. So I think what the main feeling people had was that they all participated in this process of creating the PT, creating the conditions for Lula to get elected. And so that was very moving. People were crying on the streets because they felt that this was their own victory. And we actually saw that earlier, the day of the election. People took to the streets in massive numbers. It was like the World Cup. Brazil had won the World Cup with the same numbers of people taking to the streets. So people did not just went to vote and then went home to watch TV. They all took to the streets, and that put the PT in a situation in which it will have to respond, because the level of expectation is very, very high. And I think Lula has a sense of the responsibility that he has right now, not only in Brazil, but there was a lot of expectation throughout Latin America.
I'm just looking at an AP piece that says, breakfast with Hugo Chavez, dinner with Fidel Castro. The first day in office for Brazil's new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, projects the image of a leftist alliance in Latin America, one that Chavez, Venezuela's president, has already nicknamed the Axis of Good. Such an alliance would hinder U.S. efforts to create a free trade area of the Americas stretching from Alaska to the tip of Argentina by 2005. Despite the perception of a new Latin American troika, doubts abound that Silva really wants to form a bloc with such close ties to Chavez and Castro. But by giving Latin America's other two leftist leaders such a warm welcome a day after his inauguration, Silva gets huge political mileage in Brazil, where Castro and Chavez are revered by the, as AP put it, the far left of his party. The United States sent Trade Representative Robert Zoellick to the inauguration, seen by the Brazilians as something of a snub because Zoellick suggested last October that Brazil's only trading partner would be Antarctica if it did not join the hemispheric trade zone. Silva responded by calling Zoellick, quote, the subsecretary of a subsecretary of a subsecretary during the election campaign. At the breakfast meeting, Chavez asked Silva to send technical experts from Brazil's state-owned oil company to replace some of the 30,000 Venezuelan state oil workers who've joined a crippling nationwide strike. Silva said he would consider the request. What about that relationship between Brazil and Venezuela and how important that is? Let me go back to Professor Moncada.
Well, for us, it's absolutely important. I mean, we think that President Lula in Brazil is a good friend of the Venezuelan people. And it's incredible that Brazil just sent an oil tanker with gasoline to help Venezuelans. And the opposition here has been protesting in front of the Brazilian embassy just because President Lula and former President Cardoso just are trying to help Venezuelan people. What I think is common between Mr. Lula and Mr. Chavez is the concern for the poor, the concern for the Indians, the blacks, the women, the poor women of the country, the weak of the country who have never been in mind or inside of the elites of both countries. The poor for them have been always out of their mind, out of their sight, and it's important now the majorities of the population of both countries have hope of bettering their situation through democracy. And it's important to see that for the first time in Latin America, the poor think that democracy is good for them, and the elites are thinking that democracy is not so good because it's not working for their corporate interests. It's incredible, our situation right now.
And Maísa Mendoza, how do people see Venezuela in Brazil right now?
For people in the U.S. to understand that in Brazil, it's not such a big deal for our president to receive Fidel Castro or Hugo Chavez, because even the former government, the Cardoso government, had good relationships with those countries. And so even Cardoso sent oil to Venezuela, because I think we have a very strong sense that we need to keep a good relationship with our neighbors, and people are very aware of the damaging influence that the U.S. has in destroying democracy in Latin America. We have seen this in the 60s. I think the situation in Venezuela now is very similar to what happened in Chile when Allende suffered a coup backed up by the CIA, by the U.S. government. I mean, all the dictatorships in Latin America were backed up by the U.S. government, so this is not new for us. We have a very good sense of that, and now that we are coming back to a situation of democracy all over the continent, I think people are much more conscious about this, and that's why I think the victory of Lula in Brazil is very representative, not only for Brazilians, but for people throughout the continent.
What will the World Social Forum be like this year, which is going to happen in just a few weeks? You're on the coordinating committee of that major event that has now taken place for the last few years. Now that Lula is president of Brazil and Chavez is embattled in Venezuela.
Yeah, I think the World Social Forum is becoming bigger and bigger, and this is a sign that shows that people all over the world want to have different economic policies. They know that there are alternatives for the model that is now being implemented almost everywhere in the world, the neoliberal economic model. So last year we had about 60,000 official delegates in the forum. This year we're expecting 100,000 people. And Amy, we're very happy you were coming to forum in the last 2 years, and he's going to be there again this year as a special guest. And we know that people all over the world want to see Lula, want to see what he has to say, although this is a forum for civil society to get together and to show public opinion in general that there are alternatives for the current economic model. And just another thing that I think is important in terms of the relationship between Brazil and Venezuela is that Lula has invited Venezuela to become a part of the Mercosul, which is the trade agreement between Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, in Argentina. So I think Lula can now play an important role in Latin America to unite our countries and to resist the influence of the United States, especially with the pressures for the free trade area of the Americas to be implemented. And I mean, you know that there is a very strong resistance to that in Brazil. We had the referendum, in a grassroots referendum, in which more than 10 million people voted against the FTAA. And I think the World Social Forum represents this very strong resistance to neoliberal policies.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Maria Luisa Mendonça speaking to us from Rio, Brazil. Greg Palast, right here in our Firehouse studio, investigative reporter with BBC, Guardian, Observer, and also author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And joining us from Venezuela, Professor Moncado from the University of Caracas in Venezuela. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about missionaries around the world. Stay with us.
Presentimiento de que pronto llegará la separación. Si ayer fue felicidad, hoy es tristeza, pero qué angustia, melancolía, desilusión, como cuando hay la sensación de agua con viento. Tengo ya el presentimiento barruto en mi corazón.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In Yemen, dozens of students have reportedly been detained following the killings of three U.S. missionaries and the assassination of a leading secular politician. Last Saturday, Yemeni Socialist Party leader Jerala Omar was assassinated. 2 days later, three missionaries were shot dead at a Baptist hospital. Killed in the incident were hospital administrator William Cohn, purchasing agent Kathleen Garrity, and Dr. Martha Myers. The three hospital workers were members of the Southern Baptist International Mission Board. Martha Myers was a Montgomery, Alabama native. Along with the others, she was killed while working in the hospital in Yemen. Myers was an obstetrician and surgeon who graduated from the University of Alabama at Birmingham Medical School and spent 24 years in Yemen as a medical missionary. The service for Dr. Myers was held yesterday in Dauphin Way Baptist Church. And there are services being held for the other missionaries here in the United States as well. The last time missionaries made it to the media's radar screen was the fall of 2001. During the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, the Taliban detained Dana Curry and Heather Mercer. They were incarcerated for 3 months on charges of spreading Christianity. In November, U.S. Special Forces helicopters rescued them from a prison outside Ghazni, Afghanistan. In October of that year, Islamic militants opened fire on a church built by missionaries in Pakistan, killing 16 Christians. Around the same time, Muslim rebels threatened to execute 2 missionaries kidnapped in the Philippines. Well, today we're going to look at the phenomenon of Christian proselytizing in the Muslim world. We're joined on the telephone by Barry Yeoman. He's a freelance journalist who wrote an investigative piece for Mother Jones magazine called The Stealth Crusade. Last year, Barry Yeoman attended a private training session of Frontiers, the largest Christian group in the world that focuses exclusively on proselytizing to Muslims. Barry Yeoman, can you talk about the Frontiers organization and what happened at the session that you went to?
Sure. Frontiers is the largest organization that's specifically focused on the Muslim world, though, of course, there are groups such as the Southern Baptists who have a much wider scope. Frontiers has 800 missionaries who work in 50 countries, and they make no bones about the fact that they are not there simply for humanitarian aid, but that they are there to spread the gospel. They believe that ultimately what's more important than food in your stomach or money for housing is that you have access to heaven, and they believe that Muslims have no access to heaven.
You talk about the weekend that you spent at Columbia International University in South Carolina, a weekend that was led by someone who may not be well-known on the national scene, but is very well-known in the evangelical world, named Love. Can you talk about him and how he told missionaries to behave around the world?
Sure. Rick Love is like the Elvis of that world. He's a very charming, leather jacket wearing, hyperactive man who just makes you want to like him. And he spent these 2 weeks training a group of, I would say, 30 missionaries, most of whom had spent some time in the field already, about how to penetrate Muslim culture. The thing that he stressed over and over was that the calling to convert Muslims is more important than any laws in these countries that make what they are.
Let me just quote someone that you quoted in your piece.
Sure.
Kim McHugh, the 36-year-old student who is training to convert Iranian refugees in Turkey. She said, I believe, she's talking about Islam, I believe it's a false religion. I'd like to see it be gone.
Yes. This was a sentiment that was echoed over and over. And the basic theme was that you do this by any means possible. Not by force, obviously, but by whatever sort of subterfuge it took to get into the country. So that would mean applying for a visa to do aid work or to teach or to run a small business or to be a student. And you integrate yourself into the culture, and only once you're in do you start to very, very subtly build a network of converts. Many of these countries have laws that make this very much legal. So what Rick Love said to these students is that while you never lie, you never tell the whole truth about why you're there, and you hold church services in people's houses. You have them look as much like Muslim services as possible. You might not even say that you're Christian. You might say that you're Muslims of the Holy Savior. But you find ways to subtly bring people to Christianity.
Barry Yeoman, you wrote this piece in Mother Jones called The Stealth Crusade. Inside one Southern University, Christian missionaries are being trained to go undercover in the Muslim world and win converts for Jesus, their stated goal to wipe out Islam. Another way you say that they operate is to, for example, say they're English teachers.
Right.
Where is that done?
They pretty much have a different attack in every country. So they might be English tutors in, say, Indonesia, while they might be running a small business that employs Muslims in some other country. They find these ways to have a captive audience, so that if you run a carpet factory, which is something that Frontiers has done, then you have a labor force who's in the factory every day, and they are easy pickings for proselytizing.
We've seen the dangers that missionaries face. What about the dangers of people who have been proselytized or converted by these missionaries?
Well, one thing that strikes me as very interesting about the press that these missionaries from Yemen have received is that the number of Christian missionaries who are harmed is tiny, but the number of their converts who face high risks is enormous. The Southern Baptists themselves have a hefty document that says that you will probably be pretty safe as a missionary. You're likely to be thrown out of the country if they catch you, but you probably won't be killed. You probably will not end up in prison. However, the people who you bring to Christ will be imprisoned, they'll be tortured, they'll be beaten, they'll be killed. They'll certainly be estranged from their families at minimum, but they're likely to suffer much worse fates. What's very interesting about the same study is that it says, even though that will happen, you should not back off from what you're doing, because it's more important that these people make it into heaven.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Barry Yeoman, author of the piece in Mother Jones magazine called The Stealth Crusade, looking at how some groups of missionaries present themselves around the world, particularly focusing on the Columbia International University in South Carolina. You are listening to Democracy Now! That does it for the show. If you want to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Nogara, Alex Wolf. Rich Kim is our engineer. And our email address is mail@democracynow.org. Our website, democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mario Murillo, and it's great to see him back at Pacifica Station WBAI. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Pourtant, j'étais